Hey folks, welcome to the Unsung Podcast. We did it last week together. We're no longer doing it together.
Didn't you know, COVID is over.
Live your life as normal.
The king is dead. Long live the king. Yeah. We've got 1 week of being in a room together. Now David's isolating. I don't know about you guys, but last night, five of my colleagues tested positive for COVID, which added on to the people just a couple of days prior. Both bands that I'd put on tested positive for COVID. And yeah, total disarray, total disconnect from reality. And then as I was coming home, I was walking by these two guys walking along drinking tinnies, and one of them saying, "By the way, if that fucking flu's worse than COVID this year now, man. This is ridiculous." It's unbelievable. Unfucking believable. How you doing?
Apart from that, I'm fine.
That is Chris Cusack, and the last person that spoke there is David Weaver.
Hi there.
Sorry, I need to just get out of my system.
Yeah,
because
you feel better.
If I'd caught up with them, I would have said something, because I got into an argument with a guy when I was trying to buy a sandwich. He was giving out all that as well. I was about three back in the queue as well, but I just stuck my head in the corner. I was like, he was like talking to the girl at the counter, and she's kind of like clearly just trying to humour her. I'm like, "Here, mate, she doesn't want to tell you you're a fucking crackpot, but I'll tell you, you're a fucking crackpot. Now fuck off so we can all get our sandwiches." Didn't they like that much?
I can imagine. I can just see this comedy moment of like, you know, just like this guy, and then a cut to a blank wall, and then you stuck your head around like,
"Why is this taking so long? And why can I hear pish?" Yeah. So here we are again, over the internet. It's a shame. I kind of miss you.
I miss you already.
Yeah, it was nice to actually see you in the flesh for one day.
A whole day. Whole bit of a day. Speaking of people in the flesh, I want to thank the entire population of Greece. Because for the last week we've been in the iTunes chart in Greece, which is awesome. So thank you, all Greek people.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks very much. I hope your country is doing all right. You've had a bit of a shit time recently. So obviously our dulcet tones to cheer them up.
Yeah, but they've got British tourists going back into their country now, so it can only get worse.
Why the hell are they listening to us then?
Did we not get into the charts in the UK?
I was going to say maybe we shouldn't thank the people of the UK, even though we did get in the charts in the UK as well.
Let's not be ungracious, alright? Not everybody in the UK is a fucking roaster.
That's true.
Just about 95% of them.
Maybe it was like the people had been to Greece and were listening to the podcast in Greece, came back to the UK and had to isolate and listen to the podcast in the UK.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, what was that great podcast we heard when we were in Greece? We should track that down. Where's that from? Scotland. Don't know about that.
So talking about really British things, What album are we doing today, Chris?
I went big today. This is something that's been on my mind for a wee while. This is a massive band. Like, straight out the gate here, I don't see this getting voted in, and I don't particularly care.
So you're just going to waste our time.
No, there's, as with so many of the episodes we've done, there's a useful conversation to be had. The band is the Arctic Monkeys, and the album is Humbug from 2010. I want to have a conversation about the decisions around this record, what it says about that band, because I think it's interesting. I mean, as I said, this is a big band. I mean, this band, for example, got supported by them Crooked Vultures, which for the uninitiated is Josh Homme, John Paul Jones of Led Fucking Zeppelin, and Mr. Dave Grohl, who was in a couple of reasonably successful projects, and they supported Arctic Monkeys. So this is a very successful band that doesn't need publicity, but there is a really interesting conversation within this band. And frankly, I kind of want the opportunity to prove that I don't just hate people because they're successful, right? Because I think there's definitely the danger that we paint ourselves into that corner.
You just hate people as soon as they sign to a major label.
No, that's not true. That's not true. I mean, I like Bad Religion. Their best albums were on a major label, debatably. Yeah, but, look, just to preempt this, sometimes when a band gets huge, and especially if our first impressions are kind of indifferent, Or if we just miss the boat, you know, sometimes we all go through phases where we tune out of something or we get into a different style of music for a while. Whatever, it just means that the band, as they get huge, they just end up being there, like looming around in pop culture in a big way. But you actually, a lot of the time, we end up not really engaging with them. Like, we don't engage in much detail. We don't really get any sort of...
It's like people who miss HBO series as they're going out.
It's like me and Sopranos, absolutely, yeah. And, you know, you don't end up with any sort of nuanced picture of the band or their decisions or even really their output. And, you know, maybe a lot of the time, certainly a lot of the time, that's pretty fair. A lot of the stuff is just big, stodgy pish, but not all of it. And I feel like we're maybe in a position for a lot of listeners who, despite, maybe because of the status of this band, might be kind of unaware of them. In any detail, because they are just a big looming presence that you're like, oh, well, there's nothing there for me to get interested in. And I don't want us to obviously get dragged down into indie hell, because you can just end up spaffing on about a band that's already got copious fucking column inches devoted to it. But I think there is definitely something there to discuss, and obviously to do that we do need to address a bit of the context. So it's very likely this is going to be two, hopefully not over long episodes, where we kind of pick this apart. There's a lot of interesting references and stuff in the process, and genuinely, I've got a fucking killer nexus at the end of this. We're nexusing to the baby son from Teletubbies, as chosen by our man Craig Down Under, and I got a total belter, so it's worth coming back for that alone. But yeah, I mean, that all said about the popular culture, I kind of want to take your temperature on this one, pardon the COVID pun, I guess. But I mean, Mark, for example, where were you on Arctic Monkeys before I brought this to the table?
Indifferent. I know they're a huge band, probably one of the biggest band in the UK of our generation, I would imagine, in terms of popularity, guitar band at least anyway. I remember the first record coming out, Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not. I remember A Bit Like Good in the Dance Floor being huge because it was kind of coming at the tail end of all that Strokesy stuff that was happening at that time, and obviously who were a huge influence on them and kind of who they wanted to be, maybe not sonically, but, you know, were definitely influenced by their level of fame and songwriting nous, if you, that's putting it quite politely. So yeah, I was completely indifferent to them. Whenever I heard a single on the radio, I thought, yeah, it's pretty good guitar, sort of pop music. I think that serves the genre quite well. I like the fact he uses his Sheffield accent. I think that's pretty cool. I like the fact that they actually like chunky production. I think a lot of indie bands can always go really weedy. These guys definitely don't, even though the guitars themselves aren't mega distorted. Everything sounds fat and big and nice all the time, which is pretty cool.
Did they come across as, I know it's a bit of a kind of simple term, but like legit? Did they come across as being like a real band?
I guess everybody's first, but if you were on MySpace back in the day, everybody's first brush with them was this fucking random band come out of nowhere with this massive song that was just all over MySpace before they would even sign to a major label, or so it seemed anyway. I don't know if they were signed to a major label when that video came out, but there was certainly no feeling that they were signed to a reasonable label at that point. So it did feel as, oh, these guys are pretty cool, and then suddenly they were massive. And they seem to have dealt quite well with that fame as well.
Yeah, let's talk about MySpace in a wee bit. Dave, what about you, man? I mean, I'm sure you're a bit more familiar with them, but what are your feelings?
Yeah, I mean, I guess they're a band that I've always... Like, legitimacy is the word. They've always seemed legit to me. And I get, you know, I hear the singles, and I've listened to the records, and I enjoy it. I guess it's maybe... It's just maybe not spiky enough for me, or it's, you know... But I very much... I'm very happy that they exist. I know there is space for them, and I know they're not dicks. I kind of feel like they are, I don't know. Yeah, they kind of seem to have a legitimacy now, and we'll talk about how they've earned that, you know, with their records. But they are now kind of like a sort of national treasure-ish type, like moved up to the level of, they're like a fucking working class Radiohead, basically. And they're allowed to do what they want to do. Although I don't listen to the albums very much, I've quite liked them from afar. I will allow them to exist. You know, much in opposition to, say, the Libertines, who I just think are pricks and I fucking hate them.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's a good comparison. It's interesting because I think then we're all coming from a fairly similar place. I think maybe of the three of us, I'm the one that's dabbled the most of them, and the reason is because of this album, because especially because I was such a big fan of Queens of Stone Age that I sought it out when I knew they were working with Josh Homme, which we'll go into in a bit of detail. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you guys say, they're a huge band, and normally I'd find that a wee bit off-putting, frankly, but did always seem that even if I didn't like everything they were doing, there were a lot of cool ideas in there, and it was just, it was authentic, you know. And it's interesting you said the working class Radiohead. It's actually quite a fun turn of phrase, you know. Even the music's obviously a lot less proggy, but it's actually been pretty far out at times, especially recently. We'll talk a wee bit about the albums. Just for, I mean, the thing is, we take them for granted because we're British. We've got a lot of listeners that aren't British. Although I'm pretty sure most listeners will at least be familiar with Arctic Monkeys. We're not going to have a...
We should maybe mention, because Mark mentioned a major label, but they've released stuff on a major label, I think, through Warner in the States. But throughout their career, they've been signed to Domino in the UK, you know, which is not an officially major label. So they've maintained a level of independence. And I think they are something like, maybe not the, but one of the biggest selling independent artists of all time.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that that deal they have with Domino, they were approached by the owner of Domino, Lawrence Bell, and they signed with Domino specifically because they said they loved that home-based DIY approach, that labour of love thing he does. He only signs bands that he likes musically and also that he likes personally, apparently. So yeah, you're right. They obviously, you know, even from the, I think it was like right from the very beginning, there was rumours and papers that they were doing distro via EMI and Epic, although the band denied that right back at the start. And I think some of the sales figures for the first album suggest they probably didn't have massive distro for it, but they certainly do now. We'll just throw in a wee bit of background. As Mark mentioned, the Sheffield accent, they're from Sheffield, which is, what's that, the north of England. It's just very close to Leeds, very working class.
Home of Def Leppard.
Home of Def Leppard, sure played a big part in their sound. I mean, Arctic Monkeys, pretty hellish name. A lot of sarcastic explanations for their name are available in various interviews, but none are really confirmed. It seems like they're kind of trolling with it. Frankly, it just sounds like a kind of high school band name that's stuck. I think they generally credit its invention to the second guitarist, who is, was that Jamie Cook? So it's Alex Turner is the front man, the main songwriter, vocalist, guitarist, the sort of person that's on most of the, you know, to the fore in most cases. Jamie Cook on second guitar, Matt Helders on drums and vocals. Matt's actually got a fairly prominent role in the band as well. He's become a reasonably successful producer. He sings a few tracks. He's quite heavily involved in it. You know, he's far from just this random guy at the back. And they're now, and have for most of their career, had Nick O'Malley on bass. Although the founder member was actually a guy called Andy Nicholson, who I believe it was something to do with like just fatigue in the first year of being in the band. He just couldn't deal with it. He was replaced by O'Malley temporarily, but then it became permanently for whatever reason. As you guys said, they've made jokes. They've actually got jokes inside their lyrics about wanting to be the Strokes, but you can tell that they owe a fair bit to some of the other names that were mentioned. I would suggest maybe The Hives from 2000. See the robot, write up his name on the ballot. They say, this is all I need to get by. The truth is, baby, it's a lie. They've got that kind of indie punky energy. The Vines, and that was about 2002, so that was just before they... It was just as they were getting together. I also think going back a little bit earlier, well, a good bit earlier, you've got the likes of The Jam. I think you've got Sham 69, that working class thing. Also, I find that their style of music reminds me a lot of the Kinks, because obviously
Kinks are a big one for me. Yeah. Girl, I want to be with you all of the time. The only time I feel
Yeah, obviously they've got that really gritty, you know, All of the Night, you know, You Really Got Me. They've got the riffy stuff that we were talking about. But then with the Kinks, you've got, you know, all these other much more elaborate things like Lola and stuff like that, and Sunny Afternoon. Arctic Monkeys do that. They have chunky riffy stuff, but they also have this very British kind of off-kilter indie stuff. One thing I think about them that needs to be mentioned is the style of the lyricism. I think Alex Turner's made, it was a masterstroke. He wasn't actually the original singer, but, you know, really early on he became the singer. And it was a masterstroke putting him in charge of the lyrics, because he's got a really identifiable style. I don't know how many people are familiar with a guy called John Cooper Clarke, but John Cooper Clarke's a musician and a poet, and he's very famous for what they called like punk poetry.
Like a nightclub in the morning, you're the bitter end. Like a recently disinfected shithouse, you're clean round the bend. You give me the horrors, too bad to be true. All of my tomorrows are lousy because of you. You put the shat in shatter, you put the pain in Spain. Your germs are splattered about. Your
this blending of like vernacular, like working class urban slang and prose, and it really, really astute, you know. So maybe passed off sometimes as being quite basic, but actually like incredibly intelligent stuff and very relatable. And I mean, there's a few artists that probably utilize that style, but I think Arctic Monkeys are certainly one of the most successful. And in fact, for the, I think it's the closing track on AM, which is their fifth album that, yep, we'll talk about later. But the track I Wanna Be Yours, actually the lyrics are a John Cooper Clarke poem, and he's a big fan of them. I wanna be a Ford Cortina, I will never rust. If you like your coffee hot, let me be a coffee pot. Charts-wise, ridiculously successful. I mean, even considering that they arrived in the after the sort of internet cull began, they've got 20-plus million global sales, although they've never had a number one US album, which I think is quite interesting. I think other than their debut album, Humbug, the one that we're going to talk about in detail, was their lowest charting album in the USA, which is also interesting. What is it called? Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino, their most recent album, which we'll get a mention because it's unusual. That's the fastest selling vinyl album of the millennium. In fact, I think it's of the last 25 years, if I remember rightly. In the UK, Humbug and the album that came after it, Suck It and See, which are quite similar in a lot of ways, they have similar sales figures of around about 410k, but I mean, some of the other records are multiples of that. And as you said, Dave, they're not just one of the most successful independent bands, they're the first independently signed band in the UK to debut at number one with all six albums. They've far and away got that record.
Their first album actually charted in the UK album charts last year. It's charted numerous times. It's been in the indie charts for 706 weeks.
Yeah, which just shows you how fucking relevant they continue to be. Mm-hmm. 2005, I think they actually got together as early as 2002 or something like that, but in 2005, they had an 18-track demo or something that was kicking about for a while, but they released an EP called 5 Minutes with the Arctic Monkeys. Which was a limited press, and I think it was just done by themselves, self-released, got a bit of attention from BBC Radio, and then they appeared on one of this, I think it was the Carling stage, one of the smaller feeder stages at Reading and Leeds for bands that are sort of seen as being up and coming. And then they were approached by Lawrence Bell and Domino, who they signed with. And then you get this first juncture that, you know, you've already touched on, I think it's worth talking about, MySpace. Clearly a bit anachronistic now, but I mean, their method of breakthrough, which was largely via MySpace and largely via that song, I Bet That You Look Good in the Dance Floor. was pretty much unprecedented, and they just, without a mammoth advertising budget, you know, especially the kind of budget usually thrown at bands to try and break them these days, they just had this incredible sudden burst of success. I mean, the band claimed they didn't even set up that MySpace, that it was originally set up by fans of them that noticed that they didn't have one, and so they set it up, and then I don't know if it got handed over and they ended up curating it. But when that happened to them, MySpace was, for one sort of fleeting moment, seen as being this, the precursor for this new way to do music, this democratization of music, a way to circumvent the old ways, the old guard, the gatekeepers. But I mean, as is obvious now, that didn't last. I mean, almost as soon as that became apparent, it was monetized, and those kind of patterns of monopolization and gatekeeping re-emerged. So basically the door that they stepped through was quickly barred behind them. But I think that MySpace era is fascinating. I mean, as you said, Mark, that was your first experience of them. But what did you guys make of it? Did Dave, I know you used MySpace because you used to talk to famous folk on it.
Christian old wobblers from Fear Factory, you mean? It was interesting because, like, for me, MySpace, and I guess it still seemed very genre orientated for me in terms of, like, metal and emo and all the stuff we were talking about last week. And it was bands like, I don't know, fucking like Bring Me the Horizon and Bullet for My Valentine and stuff like that, that I remember coming up through MySpace. And it was bands in Glasgow that were, you know, had thousands and thousands of followers on MySpace. And I'd be like, oh, holy fuck. And then I didn't realise that indie music was happening on it and that people without fringes were using it. but then I remember this coming out. Was I still living at home? I can't remember. I just remember seeing it in Allness Morrison's, and I was like, "Fuck, that's a band I've kept hearing about." And I've heard that song, and I can't believe they're big enough to be in Morrison's now. But like, it was in like the second week that it came out, so it went to number one. But you know,
can you imagine if we manage to make anything of this podcast one day and it becomes some kind of cult thing? There'll be a little like unsung map of Scotland. You have to go and do a pilgrimage in one of them. It'll be the Allness Morrison.
Yeah, Allness Morrison's will definitely be there.
Mark, I mean, what was your take on the MySpace period? It did seem to me, a bit like Dave says, that it was really geared towards emo and stuff, but maybe that was just what we were seeing. Maybe that was just the circles we moved in.
Yeah, that's definitely just what you were seeing, because I remember MySpace being huge for every kind of music at that time. I was not surprised when a band broke through from it, you know? Those artists were using it for their own ends. I mean, when Tom decided to sell it, one of the people that were involved in the consortium that bought it was Justin Timberlake. It was huge for every kind of artist, you
That's
know.
That's right.
And I think that, I mean, at that time, it was really easy on a platform. It was really easy on a platform like MySpace to get like hooked into like the one kind of genre, because it was way different than how you shared stuff on, like how you share stuff on LinkedIn and Twitter. You know, like, so it's like significantly different. And it was a much more social media was in infancy, so I thought it was really interesting that there was an indie band for sure, but I wasn't surprised because it just seemed to me to be a logical extension of the sudden explosion of stuff that had happened in the early 2000s with the Strokes and the Hives. This just seemed to be the next way this was going to go. It was not long after this that I started up my own music website and was running that, and you know, people would be sending you MySpace links all the time.
Well, no. It was 2006 that Sandy Tom came out with that Abomination. Absolutely. I Wish I Was a Punk Rocker. I was a punk rocker with flowers in my hair. 77 and 69, revolution was in the air. I was born too late to a world that doesn't care. Oh, I wish I was a punk rocker with flowers in my hair. I think we've talked about how her manager basically falsified the amount of views, and she got big off pretending that she was doing live streaming. But like, she was a MySpace personality, basically, a MySpace artist. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I just thought it was all metalcore bands from Aberdeen, but it turns out that everybody was fucking using it.
You know, it's just interesting though, because with Arctic Monkeys, it did seem sort of grassroots, and I, like, obviously I've got a cynical eye, and I was hyper suspicious, but I was just looking at it, it's like, not, I mean, this does just seem like a thing that's happened. It does actually seem like there's just been a grassroots embrace of this tune, and it's just everywhere. And then now the TV channels are being forced to respond to that to try and seem relevant. It seemed like the people that used the site were dictating the relevance instead of what tends to try and happen now, which is that they're trying to do it in reverse, which is like they dictate the relevance and then everybody latches on, or they simply monopolise the channels of distribution and make it impossible to see anything else. And it's interesting that it was so brief. I mean, it wasn't long before Facebook kicked in, was it? And I don't know. I mean, all these things, as soon as their potential is revealed, they get seized upon. I mean, I really hope that Justin Timberlake has the last laugh. I really do. Mm-hmm. I really fucking hope that people get a bit like people got fed up with CDs and digital and ended up buying vinyl in record numbers. I really hope people get jaded and fucked off with Facebook and all its bollocks. And like MySpace becomes the sort of digital equivalent of vinyl, where people are like, fuck it, I'm going back to MySpace. It's just better. It sounds better. Hear the warmth. I would love to see that take place, man.
For me, the very concept of virality, internet virality for music, begins with this band. I can't escape that when I hear them. You know, and the lineage can be seen all the way right through to TikTok now, where artists will break out of nowhere.
Yeah.
You know, it really does begin with this band, particularly, especially in the UK. You know,
see, just can I just clarify Mark's accent? Because Mark's got a deep accent. It sounded like he said virility, but he actually said virality.
Virality, yeah.
the two are quite different.
It depends where you are.
Depends who the band is.
Yeah, totally. But, you know, I Bet You Look Good and Dance Floor went to number one in the charts. So it worked for that very brief period. I think it worked. It probably worked in much the same way that this is going back way before the internet, I suppose. But when Iron Maiden released Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter and asked all their fans to buy it over Christmas, which is like the quiet period for that record coming out, and everybody bought all the versions of it, and it went number one. That would be kind of the modern day equivalent of that, right? All your friends see that song and they'll go out and actually buy the single, because this was pre-downloads. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge thing for a band that on a, like you said, an indie label and... came through the fucking internet.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, smash hit for that year, straight to number one, and their next single did the same, When the Sun Goes Down, which I think a lot of people know as Scummy.
And what a scummy man, just give him half a chance, I bet he'll rob you if he can. Can see it in his eyes, yeah, that he's got a driving ban amongst some other offences.
But that's not the actual name of it, it got changed. But that did the same the following January in 2000, Dance Floor was October 2005, Scummy was January 2006, and that's when the album dropped, the debut, whatever people say I am, that's what I'm not. Really high energy indie record, as I said earlier, a kind of Sham 69, bits of The Clash in it as well, kind of punk energy, but then it's got a much bigger appeal to like mods. It has like a little mod vibe to it that, you know, it really took with like the likes of Oasis fans. It is ironic, I think, that it took Oasis fans, given that it's probably much more analogous to the likes of Blur.
I've always seen them, like, in terms of this new wave of English indie, I've always seen them as the Blur much more than...
Think about the lyrics to Parklife, that kind of Cooper Clark style lyricism. I mean, it's much more in common with that than it does with, like, Noel Gallagher's lyrics. I mean, the album starts really strong. I mean, it's a surprisingly good listen, although I do think it runs out of steam halfway. I mean, they're a really young band. You can't really criticise them for that. The early tracks are full of really interesting ideas. I mean, seriously, if you approach it with an open mind and you're a fan of Fugazi, there's stuff in there that you would appreciate. And yeah, the lyrics really help propel it along. I think that first tune on it, The View from the Afternoon, loads of really innovative guitar parts in it, a couple of really crunchy riffs, a very hooky little chorus. One of the diamond moments that really set their stall out is about 2 minutes 15 into that. The song drops out completely for a good few seconds and then comes back with this kind of stereo guitar trade-off syncopated thing that is like pure like Ian MacKaye, Guy Picciotto, brilliant fucking original idea on guitar. And I think it just shows that this band were just a good, like, a league above a lot of the bands that they were around and showed a lot of growth potential for the future. The second track in that was about you leaving the dance floor. Alex Turner says that's a shit song and he doesn't want it to be what they're remembered for, but I bet they don't mind the royalty checks, and frankly, they probably wouldn't be where they are now if it wasn't for that song. I think sometimes you just have to accept that fact.
You just have to accept that you've written a really fucking catchy as fuck song, and it might not be your deepest cut, but it is catchy and it's clever. For a radio pop song, it's sparky and it's funny and it's interesting.
Mark, what did you think of that first record?
I really liked Fake Tales of San Francisco. I thought that was a pretty good song.
Yeah, that's a great song. Kick me out, kick me out. I don't want to hear you. Kick me out, I don't want to hear you. I don't want to hear you. Fake Tales of San Francisco echo through the air.
Really nice chorus, and when the sun goes down as well. Playful. Really playful at the start, and then it goes into something a bit dirty. But yeah, I really can't get behind anything as a comparison to this band, though, mate. Sorry, but that's
yeah, I thought you were stretching a little bit. Like, I know you're not comparing them to Fugazi, but like they have guitars.
Let's put it this way, right? Fugazi said they wouldn't have existed if it wasn't for Gang of Four. Mm-hmm. And I think Arctic Monkeys show a lot of the same sensibilities. That kind of, like, that nuanced guitar interplay. I'm not saying they're on the same genetic line, but I'm saying they've branched off from a similar point of ideas. That bit in The View from the Afternoon, where the guitars break down like that, it's very interesting. It's a very, very interesting bit of guitar music, and it's not typically indie. It's somewhere in between indie and punk, and I think that's what I'm getting at. I'm not saying the songs sound like Fugazi or are approached like Fugazi, but there's an innovation and a willingness to sort of break the mould in there that I think is consistent between the two bands. Honestly, I think if people go at it with an open mind, they will see, like, alright, shit, these young guys weren't just looking for easy options. A lot of people do go out there and just try and sound exactly like the Strokes. They weren't doing that.
Some of that kind of shit, I definitely think, probably comes from the stuff with the Beatles and that, which he was huge, Alex Turner was hugely influenced by.
Fuck the Beatles.
Yeah. But you can't
you can't talk about English indie pop music without talking about the Beatles. The Beatles invented all of this music.
And his dad was a huge fan as well. So, like, he's a huge fan of the Beatles.
Beatles.
But, like, his dad was a music teacher as well, right? So I guess he was probably quite proficient. It looked like he was quite proficient from an early age.
Don't get me wrong. I'm being churlish, right? I get it. And the Beatles influences pop up a lot, especially the John Lennon influences, I would suggest. But... Mm-hmm. I think it's tempered with a lot of like punk and post-punk sensibilities, and I think bands like Gang of Four are that common ancestor between what bands like this did over here and what bands like Fugazi and stuff did in the States. Art punk, and it is kind of like bordering on art punk at points. I think there's a lot of wire in it as well, those kind of things, you know? Arctic Monkeys could do a killer cover of Outdoor Miner. No blind spots in the leopard's eyes.
Do you know that their first gig was recorded?
I didn't know that.
And it actually has four of their original songs and four covers, which is The Beatles, The White Stripes, The Undertones and The Datsuns, which is a totally bizarre influence.
I guess it shows the time it was happening at, yeah.
Yeah.
Fucking Datsuns, where are they now?
Age of 15, mental.
So they followed that Well, actually, I say they followed it, but it kind of crosses over. It's the second album was Favourite Worst Nightmare, which came out in 2007. It was recorded immediately after their tour cycle for the debut, which obviously was quite a long tour cycle because it took so well. I think they'd actually been writing and playing stuff on the tour from that album as it went, like live road testing it. And so there's a real consistency in sound, and I think there's a real consistency in the energy behind it. They maintain a lot of momentum, because basically as soon as they're back, they're out and doing another thing. It's really high energy. I think the opening song in that, Brainstorm, is a terrific example of where the band were coming from. I do think the album feels like the track listing, the arrangement of it was slightly more considered to avoid that sort of drop-off experience that you get with the first one. It's a bit more evenly spread. Brainstorm, first and foremost, shows that they could really fucking play. The drummer really gets a look in a big way. I mean, the video for it's quite clever as well. You know, boy playing drums outside in a kind of working class sort of state, surrounded by tower blocks and stuff like that. And it also showed they weren't content to just churn out safe music. I think.
Yeah, funnily enough, I mean, we laughed at you for mentioning Fugazi, but like the beginning of Brainstorm is basically an indie Meshuggah. So, yeah, I'll give you that one.
I'll take that as an apology. This song's got really great beats in it. The arrangement is really clever, and there's actually, you know, some of those drum fills do this thing where they sort of tumble almost off the page before they snap back in. So it's really, really ambitious. Again, you know, very quickly showing they weren't going to just take easy answers. For me, I think the fifth track in that, Fluorescent Adolescent, which I think is probably known to a lot of people as Best You Ever Had, because that's the sort of refrain in it. Everything's an order in a black hole. Nothing seems to fit to the past, though. That bloody memory's like an El Tabasco. Remember when you used to be a rascal? Oh, the boys are slag. The best you ever had. The best you ever had is just... It's a bit of a kind of cheeky, chappy, jaunty one. It kind of gets under my skin a wee bit. I think it kind of gets under a lot of the skin of people that don't like Arctic Monkeys, but it's definitely a fan favourite. The seventh one in that, I think, is one that deserves a mention. A track called Do Me a Favour. Which is the first sign of the surprisingly mature and darker, slower thing that they had ahead of them. It's got some really nice melancholy melodies early on, and the ending of that song has a big end where they take a kind of line from earlier on and just kind of like pump it up from around 2.5 minutes. And it's just objectively great songwriting. I think that tune really says a lot about where they were going to end up.
If this house is a circus, it's got the same carnival-esque vibe that comes up in Humbug. Absolutely, and in every single way, it's got that vaudeville almost feel. You know,
I'll throw a reference in there. That exact vibe that you're talking about reminds me repeatedly of The Coral. Remember the band The Coral? Mm.
The Coral, yeah. And also that band that we've done before that I couldn't remember again, the guys from Brighton with the Hot Rod.
80s Matchbox Bailing Disaster.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, they've got that same kind of gonzo, Blackpool Pier, you know, Wurlitzer thing happening.
Mm-hmm. I really liked 505 as well. I thought it was a really good closer to the album. Five, if it's a 7-hour flight or a 14. it's got a really nice, it's got a really nice lyric and a really nice vocal melody, I think.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like with these two albums, you know, after this record, there's a kind of closing of a chapter, because it's like their infancy, you know what I mean, or their adolescence, if you will, as a band. The two albums work well together. They have a really similar and consistent sound. They're going in a direction, and then what happens is, to me, quite a key event. The whole notion of Alex Turner in particular gets kind of modified by when he takes part in Last Shadow Puppets, this project that he embarked on with a guy called Miles Kane, who was a member of a band called The Rascals, and who also, I think it's interesting, is second, his two cousins were both the founder members of The Coral, which maybe it's coincidence, but it seems relevant to me somehow. There was a kind of 2 year gap here where he did this project, and I think what you see is his wider aspirations regarding his personal profile, his kind of cool image versus bratty wee lad. And I think Arctic Monkeys in a band, as a band from this point, and especially Alex, definitely begin a slow transition towards sex symbols. There's a single by Last Shadow Puppets called Miracle Aligner. Tell him what you want. Which has this really breathy, slower paced, lower key vocal, and the cool factor is much, much more apparent, and he really brings that into his repertoire. You know, the hairstyle changes. I mean, whether or not the sex symbol thing is down to how fans began to react to him, or whether it was a deliberate move, or what's probably more likely a combination of the two, it's not immediately obvious, but I will say, Arctic Monkeys definitely make a much smoother transition into sex symbol territory than the likes of Mumford & Sons. Do you remember when Mumford & Sons suddenly came out in leather tuxedos?
Yeah, well.
Coincidentally seemed to happen around about the same time it happened to Kings of Leon.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the thing. These bands sort of, they hit a kind of a ceiling, and then they have to decide where they're going to go. I think Arctic Monkeys hit a bit of a ceiling after Favourite Worst Nightmare, and they decided, you know, we need to musically completely expand our horizons here. And then that sort of aesthetically altered the band as well. They slowed it down. They lowered the key of the vocals especially. You know, he wasn't singing like, he wasn't yelping anymore. Last Shadow Puppets, I'm not a massive fan of them. Miracle Aligner's a good song. But, you know, by and large, they don't really jump out to me. I don't know if you guys have listened to them much.
I hate that first album with a burning passion.
Right. Yeah, I'm not into it at all.
But I think it does play a key part, though, in his development, especially in Turner's development, and what he, maybe how he saw himself, maybe how other people saw him, you know. It's got that sort of Damon Albarn branching out sort of quality to it, where he's suddenly shown that he's a bit more worldly and has bigger ambitions, you know. And I think, just since Humbug, which came out next, they have just appeared to slow down on each subsequent album. Now, we're going to come back to Humbug in detail, but we'll skip past that to what I think is like the second album of the second phase, Suck It and See, which came out in 2011. Now, again, they've done that thing of bringing out two albums in 2 years back to back, maintaining momentum, and two albums that are, they pair quite nicely. Suck It and See doesn't have the Josh Homme production, but it does musically have a lot of similar notes, literally and figuratively, obviously. Coming from that same similar place to Humbug, but with a touch more polish, because James Ford, who had done Favourite Worst Nightmare, I mean, Josh Homme does make a musical appearance on it. He's on a track called All My Own Stunts. The band at the start of the album seem to lean a bit more into the British indie thing. It does have some really odd inclusions throughout it. It's got some pretty ambitious twists and turns. There's a track on it that's a bit of a live favourite called Brick by Brick, which is a totally unremarkable and pretty tokenistic attempt to sort of shine a light on the drummer Matt. I just find it's such a gimmicky tune, man. It's a really underwhelming bit of music compared to other bits of what they've done, but they keep shoehorning it into live shows and stuff. I can't tell if maybe it's for some inexplicable reason it's popular with the fan base or whatever. You can still hear Josh Homme's influence, which we'll discuss shortly, on things like the kind of silky verses of Hellcat Spangled Shalalala. She flicks a red hot revelation off the tip of a tongue. It does a dozen somersaults and leaves you supercharged. That's got that really drawled, cool guy sort of singing. And there's also some big, beefy riffery. There's a track called Don't Sit Down Because I Moved Your Chair.
That's a good song. Which,
yeah, great tune, really simple riff. Has just oodles of especially older Queens of the Stone Age all over it. I think that last one, yeah, it definitely sort of reaffirms what is emerging as a growing desire to transition into being a rock band, you know, like our 5A's WK, and moving away from like indie darlings and sort of bouncy little cheeky chappies.
Yeah, I think Humbug is their development. They've stopped seeing themselves as like Joy Division or Blur, and they see themselves more as like The Who or Led Zeppelin or something. They're like, oh yeah, we can have a big fucking British legacy here.
So interestingly, that album was written not just by Turner, but that band actually got together and rehearsed all the songs before and coming up with the ideas before, instead of actually going into the studio with rough songs and then just using overdubs to make them work. It's the first time they did that, which probably explains why there's a song with Matt on it, because they actually wrote it as a band probably for the first time since the first album.
That, I mean, that song though sounds like the kind of thing you jam out in practice and then you just ding it. I don't know. It's, I guess they can afford to do it. I just don't really dig it. The track I mentioned, All My Own Stunts, the one that features Josh Homme, it's a really suitable and appropriate kind of diminished moment to get him involved. It works well. Frankly, it could easily be a Queens of Stone Age tune, and frankly, it's probably better than the bulk of what Queens of Stone Age were putting out by this stage. I mean, Queens of Stone Age had definitely hit a kind of creative dip, and it's just a pretty strong bit of music. For me, there's two tunes in this album that really stand out, and they're towards they're in the second half of the album. Pile Driver Waltz, I just think, is one of their best bits of music. I etched the face of a stopwatch on the back of a raindrop and did a swap for the sand in an hourglass. Controversially, the verses are in 4/4, they're not in waltz timing, but then the choruses are, I think it's dreamy, it's effortless, it's just this brilliant, simple guitar pop. If you're walking down the road on a sunny day such as I was today and it comes on, it's a total joy. I think it's a fucking brilliant, unpretentious bit of writing. A lot of time for it. And I also think the title track, Suck It and See, has loads of that kind of Elvis Costello jangly genius to it. That maybe nods towards a lot of 60s pop, as well as maybe some of that kind of English 80s stuff like Echo and the Bunnymen or the Psychedelic Furs. I think those two tunes are really, really excellent contemporary indie, whilst they also have a little bit of retro to them.
Pile Driver Waltz was actually on the Submarine soundtrack, which was originally a solo song.
Yeah, well, he wrote that as a a solo soundtrack. It works really well, that score to that film as well. But yeah, the fully arranged version of it is just, I think, fucking brilliant. I love the guitar tones in it. I love the choice of reverbs, and it's a really lush sounding song. So, I mean, then a really big thing happens, and they release AM in 2013. AM absolutely perplexes me, right, as an album. And that is not for a minute because I think it's bad, but it's a really mid-tempo, really dark indie rock album, and it's not even got the playfulness of some stuff by like Queens of Stone Age. There's obviously standout songs in it, but there's a few that are probably quite unremarkable, albeit, you know, well executed kind of 12 bar blues type moody crooning things. But I think one key thing about this album is it seems to correspond to that image change that the band have undertaken, morphing into like this sexy teddy boy East End sort of rascal almost. You know, this is when that kind of fascination with, what's the Cillian Murphy series called again?
Peaky Blinders.
Peaky Blinders was starting to come through, and it really seems to play into that. I mean, the thing with this album is, like, how long can you ride that train? Because, I mean, for me, even as somebody with reasonably positive feelings on the band, I do think at times in this record it starts to get quite dull. The pace, there's less variety in the tempos. I mean, it also maybe stands as a tribute to their marketing department that they were able to use their credibility to shift in such massive numbers an album that doesn't really seem to conform to what I would have thought would have been the template of contemporary indie success. I mean, the singles off it, Do I Wanna Know, is such a bizarre hit single. Have you got colour in your cheeks? Do you ever get that fear that you can't shift the tide that sticks around like summits in your teeth? Are there some... I mean, the streaming numbers in this song are fucking eye-watering.
Mm-hmm.
One and a quarter billion plays on Spotify.
Yeah, it just falls out of the top 100 streamed songs of all time on Spotify.
I mean, and when it's like sludge pop. It's like that is literally what I would call this song. It's so strange. I mean, I think it's an okay song. I'm not a huge fan of it. I have to admire the boldness.
Well, they found like that American rock radio equation that so many bands try and fail to get, or so many British bands, you know, like Oasis went over and tried to do it, and you know, all of these huge British bands went over and try to slightly tailor their sound, like pare it back a little bit, incorporate the blues a little bit more, but also just darken it, yet simplify it. And it's like that sort of Joshua Tree vibe. It's, but like more groovier and, you know, less abysmal. It's, they've just simplified it, and it doesn't necessarily sound like it's been a team of writers have sat around, but it sounds like the band have cleverly sat around and gone, all right, let's get rid of superfluous bullshit, let's focus a little bit more, let's not try like, oh, here's our little Elvis Costello bit, or here's our, it's like they've taken everything and simplified it into one very, I don't know. Yeah, I get why it's big, because it's just fucking simple. It's there, it's like, all right, here we are. It's branded. It's got very, you know, bold artwork.
Yeah,
bold, absolutely. Aesthetic.
I think that's key. You know, do you remember when this album came out? It was absolute blanket promotion.
Yeah,
like that sort of wave graphic was fucking everywhere, which is in sharp contrast to the first album, which we're kind of praising for the fact that it succeeded despite not having a huge advertising budget thrown at it.
Yeah.
Like this, like AM had an enormous advertising budget thrown at it. It was fucking everywhere. And the video and stuff like that was obviously very iconic for this tune. I get what you're saying, absolutely. You're right, they've stripped it down, but it's so slow and kind of morose that I find it really surprising that it succeeded. I don't dislike it. I just think it's really odd. The second single off that as well, it was Are You Mine?
Mm-hmm.
Was that a single?
Yep.
It's the second track. Again, has that sort of Queens of the Stone Age blues, smoothie blues thing, but it doesn't strike me as an obvious pop single. I do take your point, like by, I think it's track four, the song Arabella, almost, the verse almost has like a Pharrell vibe to it. My days am best when the sunset gets itself behind that little lady sitting on the passing side. It's much less picturesque without. Albeit that the chorus is like pure 70s rock. And the ninth track is total pop hook, you know, knowing their audience now, why do you only call me when you're high? And I'm trying to change your mind. Because that is absolutely the kind of shit that, you know, boys and girls that are into Arctic Monkeys are going to share right, left and centre, even just for its title. I think it sounds like Top Shop music, you know. Mm-hmm. Without abandoning the vibe of the album, they have definitely managed to write a Top Shop track with that. And that's no small achievement, given how odd I find the album generally. I mean, it really confuses me. It's one of those albums that really throws off my radar. I mean, I'm fair play to them. I mean, certainly if this is what I'm listening in the charts, or if this is what I'm listening to when I go into a fucking store to buy groceries, and it's not WAP and it's not Taylor Swift, I'm fucking delighted. I'm just surprised by it.
Yeah, I mean, it's has six singles. It is our highest charting, highest selling album of all time. And it is just a bit, it feels like one of those albums that deserves to be one of the highest selling albums of all time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I feel like Arctic Monkeys could have just stopped after two albums and that would have been like their legacy sealed as a Northern English working class act. And then they explored. And then AM is like, they've tried everything out. They've evolved. And then they've just suddenly become, oh yeah, we are one of the big fucking bands now. And yeah, I'm like, fuck it, yeah, they deserve it. I'm not angry about it.
That's a really interesting point that you've just finished on there, and I think we should finish on it, because I want to hold that point for 1 week in the ether and use it as a lens to look at Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino, their most recent record. They are fucking huge at this point. I think they're self-assured, really feeling confident, like they can make bold decisions and get away with it, and I think that's what comes to pass. So let's break there. Audience, next week we're going to come back with Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino, then we're going to look at Humbug in detail, and I don't know about you guys, but I've got a cracker of an Exus.
I've got a nice one. It's not huge, but it's it gets a little bit political, but yeah, looking forward to it.
Nice.
Alright troops, we'll see you next week, I guess. Have a nice time. Hope nobody gets COVID, I guess. That's what we can ask for in these days.
One entire week in this room.
Yeah, we'll try it. All right, bye.
Ciao.
Bye.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.